You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 7th of June, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one show where people with extraordinary careers, fascinating lives and incredible stories sit down to tell us what really happened, how they got to here, and what makes them tick. Today we meet an acclaimed Norwegian writer and journalist known for her ability to capture the rich texture of everyday life in some of the world's toughest environments, Afghanistan, Iraq and Chechnya. She's worked as a correspondent worldwide and is the author of such books as The Angel of Grozny, The Bookseller of Kabul, and most recently, One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway. She is the internationally renowned, award-winning Åsne Seierstad, and this is her big interview. Åsne Seierstad, welcome to The Big Interview. Let's begin at the beginning. What were the things that shaped your childhood, the moments, the memories?
Well, it was probably the feeling of being a bit different, growing up in a bit different family from most of my friends. I come from a family that's typical radical leftists from the 70s who left the big city to grow up in a smaller place so that we, the children, should know nature and not be too much pollution and everything that was bad in the 70s. So we were a family of without car, without TV, going around on bicycles in summer and on something called Spark, which is in winter, which is some kind of a sledge where you spark. That means to, you know, you use your foot to kind of get onto the ice. This city we lived in, a little town, is called Lillehammer. So it's a winter sports place. So
hosted the Winter Olympics in the 90s, yeah.
So you can imagine that several months a year you can use this spark to get along.
You say you knew you were from a slightly different family. Did you know that from very early on? Was it quite obvious to you?
It was quite obvious from very early on. And I wished I came from a different family, or I wished I came from a normal family, from an ordinary family.
Doesn't everyone think that though?
Probably. But this was the fact that I, like many girls probably, now small girls are indulged in pink and ballet dresses and things. At the time too, but I was not allowed to. So I was always dressed in homemade orange, you know, trousers that my mother had sewn, brown, nothing pink. I was not allowed to have long hair. It had to be cut short. My mother was quite a famous feminist, and she wrote children's book from a feminist perspective, one of the first writers who did that. She was quite successful. Her books were being translated around, and my father was working as a political scientist on the local university. Yeah, it was always one thing to be a princess and always having to be the, you know, the worker or something.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, did you reach a stage where you started to rebel against, you know, the things that your parents thought were very important for your life?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I never had any youth rebellion or teen rebellion or child rebellion. It was like I understood that those are the rules and that's how it is. And there's no point, even they're stronger than I am. So it's no point to rebel. And it never came later either. So now I'm more probably have taken over the views of my parents instead of rebel against it. So, well, my rebellion, maybe it has been to become a war correspondent against my parents' wish. But that's all I can think of.
Well, that sounds like, you know, quite a decent rebellion against your parents' wish, because you became a foreign correspondent at quite an early age, didn't you? You're in your early 20s when you went to Russia. First of all, before we get to that bit, why had you turned to the idea of journalism, the idea of trying to tell other people's stories?
It was actually quite by coincidence. It was never a plan. I didn't almost think that journalism was a real profession. I was quite serious when I was around 20, so I wanted to become a diplomat, work at the UN or become a political scientist like my father and do some serious work. And then I was studying in Russia in my early 20s, and as I studied there political science, I met with a guy who was advisor to the president of parliament at the time called Ruslan Kasbolatov. And then he probably wanted to impress me. And he said, oh, as a student of political science, you might be interested in meeting Kasbulatov. And I was, of course, sure. And then he rang me up a couple of days later. And then he said, I've fixed a meeting with Kasbulatov. And then we met at the White House, which is where the parliament was in Moscow by the river. And then as we were going up the stairs, he said, oh, by the way, I told him that you're a journalist. And I was like, how, what, how can you say I'm a journalist? And he's like, oh, he doesn't have time to meet with his students. So just invent the name of a Norwegian paper and ask some questions. So went
and that's how your journalism career began.
It's how it started, going into that big office of his, like the size of a dance hall. At the end, he was sitting there, this president of parliament, smoking a pipe. And we were sitting there for a long time, and my questions were normal. He didn't react. He didn't think, oh, you're not a real journalist, are you? So that was the start. And I'm still thinking, if that person hadn't told me, oh, by the way, I told him you're a journalist, I might never have gotten the idea. I don't know. I would have probably been into diplomacy now. I'm so happy I'm not.
It's something quite powerful, isn't it? The idea that as a journalist, you can go and ask people questions about their lives. And, you know, most times they will happily sit there and tell you the answers.
Yes, it is. And it is, of course, being a curious person. I'm very glad for that profession. Because what happened after this first interview, I spent a week writing it out and I thought that was it. And then this paper I sent it to in Norway, they asked me if I would become their Moscow correspondent. And I was asking, how come I don't know anything about writing? And he said, the foreign editor said, oh, it's easier to teach someone who speaks Russian journalism than to teach a journalist Russian. And he was probably right, because I knew the place. I'd lived there for years during my student years. And he saw there was, you know, something that could be developed in me. And I'm very happy for that, for an editor who actually saw that and who taught me from the very beginning.
So you found that the journey from being a fake journalist to a real journalist not too arduous?
No, I was very lucky. And this was in 1993. So this was a time when Russia was changing by the day. And it was a time where Russia was very interesting politically, and new parties were being formed. There was a very interesting debate everywhere. It was really freedom of expression, everything that Russia has lost now, but everything was opening up. So for Norway, we are neighboring countries to Russia, it was important to have someone there who spoke Russian. And of course, it was not the main papers. They would never have dared to hire someone that young. It was, you know, number two paper. So yeah, was a great start.
And after your time in Russia, as you say, which, you know, there was so much going on there, so much change, were you quite keen to then explore other parts of the world?
Yeah, I've always wanted to be a traveler. I always wanted to travel since my very early childhood. So what did I do then? I went to China, actually, and I was going to learn Chinese. And I signed up at university. I was done with journalism. I was back being a student. Signed up at a course in Chinese at the university in Beijing. And I moved in with a Chinese family who didn't speak any English. And I got a yellow bike. And I was like going to live a Chinese life. And it held for like 6 months. And then I went home for Christmas and I just never went back.
And so you ditched Chinese and you ditched the idea of being a journalist again in China. What was your next move from there?
Then I got a job at TV, Norwegian Broadcasting. And then because I'd covered the war in Chechnya extensively for this paper, I was then sent as a TV reporter to the war in Kosovo. So that was kind of my next area where I stayed for a longer period, starting off with a war around Easter of 1999. And that actually also led me into quitting as a TV journalist and starting to write my first book. I was called up by an editor and he said, oh, we'd love you to write a book about the Balkans. And I was first responding, I'm sorry, I'm a TV journalist. I'm not a book writer. And I never made that connection that you could go from one thing to the other in that way. And then they were very much insisting on, you know, we'd love to have a book idea from you from the Balkans. And I was like, okay, they're so insisting, so let me think of a book idea. I was thinking, okay, I'll give myself 5 minutes to find an idea.
5 minutes.
Yeah, I was very efficient at the time. I don't work like that any longer. So I sat down for 5 minutes at my TV desk, and I was thinking, okay, I was thinking, what if I do Serbia, which was the enemy of Europe at the time, and though the aggressor in the Balkans and in the Kosovo War. So I'll reduce the idea not to the Balkans, just to Serbia. And I'll find a collection of different Serbs from different sides, from different generations, from, you know, from arts, from fashion, from politics, from the army, from military, war crimes, prisoners. And I just wrote down different set of characters and I sent it in and they were like, yeah, we'll take that idea. And then that autumn I quit TV and I started writing this book.
It's interesting you say that, you know, you are not quite as decisive now, but the book that up until your most recent one that you were most famous for, The Bookseller of Kabul, that again was actually a pretty quick decision, wasn't it, to think, actually, I've met this character, I've now met his family, he's going to be perfect for a book, I'll ask him if I can go and live with him. I mean, that decision to realise that The Bookseller of Kabul would work was pretty quick.
Yeah, I was still very quick then. This was 2 years after, 2001. So the second book, well, I went to Afghanistan right after the terror acts in New York and Washington. And so I had the feeling that revenge would come to Afghanistan. So I was there just ahead of the American attack started. Going in from the north, and then finally after 6 or 7 weeks traveling with the Northern Alliance south, we came to Kabul, and then one of the first days I came across this shop where it said bookshop, and I went in and I see this man who's rearranging his books. Finally he can sell any book he likes. The Taliban have gone and they had quite severe censorship. And I made a story about the bookseller for my newspaper. And then many journalists did. He was very popular with journalists. So he invited for a dinner, many journalists to his house with his wives and his children and his mother. And it was set on the floor with all these generations and people. And it was the first time, even though I'd been then in Afghanistan for almost 2 months, it's the first time I saw men and women eating together. It's the first time we actually saw the women of the family, because having traveled from the north, we only were in very small, very traditional villages. So when I saw this scene and listened to the conversation, that's just as you said, I got this idea, this is a book, this is a book. And then I was so afraid. Oh, probably everybody else here is thinking the same thing. I remember Liz Doucette was one of the guests from the BBC. There were people from Washington Post, from Le Monde. There were Italian TV journalists. There were lots of very serious journalists. And then in the car back, I remember I told everyone, I want to write a book about this family, because I was thinking, the first one who says it does it. Like, yeah. I was, otherwise they will go and ask him. And they were like, all right, a book about that family. Oh. Yeah, why not? Well, nobody thought it was anything, you know, not that I remember. And then the next day I just went to him to secure it and say, you know, I'd like to move in with your family, write a book about you. How is life after the fall of the Taliban?
And at that stage, how much did you know about him?
I knew next to nothing. I mean, he was such a fascinating character. The only thing I was thinking, I was a bit worried that he would be too liberal, because he said that Afghanistan should be run to the standards of the European Union, you know, equality between men and women. He had the ideas that, you know, very, how to say, middle of the road European values.
And it didn't take long living with him to realise that he may say that, but he didn't necessarily believe it.
Yeah. So that was, of course, what I discovered. Because I was thinking, well, I'll have to move. This is the family I have. I'll move in with them, even though they're very not typical. But then two different things, what you say to Western journalists and how you live. And I think when it comes to running a family, he only had one other, how to say, model. And that was how his father, who was an illiterate man, how he ran his family. So he just continued in the same way, deciding everything. And even though he was an educated man, he was an engineer by education. He was the one, he was the patriarch, and he didn't really let the other people in the family decide. But of course, compared to most lives in Afghanistan, his daughters and his wives, and they have a much easier life and a much, probably much freer life too, because there's so much to be seen now, so much abuse happening in that country. So many young girls being married off to older men, abused, beaten up, killed. So it's still, even though this was bad enough, it's the lighter side of Kabul.
Although, even if that's the lighter side, it was still pretty depressing and brutal at times. And some of the stories you tell about what was going on inside that family, were there moments when you were living there where you thought, you know, I've got to know these people. Can I really tell the true story of their lives to the wider world? Is that actually fair?
Well, all that controversy that came after, to be honest, I did not expect it. I didn't think that what I had was so, was so full of dynamite as it was. Well, when I was writing it, I was thinking, oh, who's going to care? Who's going to read this? And I wrote it in Norwegian. The first print run was 3,000, which was good for Norway. But I never expected it to be translated, or so I thought. This was, you know, first experience after the fall of the Taliban. This is a family story, nothing dramatic, even though you say brutal, but the brutality is, there's never an open brutality. There's no abuse in the family or anyone hitting or anything like that. But it's the brutality of the system in a way. And what I found the saddest was all those lives who are just waiting to be lived. This would be women of a certain income, from families of a certain income, where you just sit around. You don't really have much to do because people are coming to clean and help you, even though they were also doing cleaning and making food and stuff. But a lot of the day was just sitting there in the dust, waiting for life to begin. And for me, I think that is the brutality of minds not being able to, fulfill their talent or having, they won't be filled up with new thoughts. And I think for me, that's a brutality. And I think that's the power of that book, that through living in this family and recounting their stories that I never found really that dramatic, only in the way that these lives that never were to be lived. That is the only way to tell, for the reader to understand the system of how Afghanistan works, is to live on the floor with that family. So I felt I had their consent to do it that way. And yeah.
Do you think if you'd known at the start it wasn't going to be just printed in Norwegian, just 3,000 print run, but actually translate into however many languages it's now been translated into, selling over a couple of million copies around the world, that either you or the family would have approached the project in a different way?
Probably. First of all, probably I would have been paralyzed by just thinking that there will be readers in Britain or America or Malaysia or Pakistan or India or China and or all these countries that the book has been translated into. And it's also like it's an impossible question, because what would we have done differently had we known? Because this became a court case that lasted more than 12 years. We tried to find settlements. There's been lots of difficulties in the case in this aftermath of the book. So, of course, had I known. But one never can live backwards. So it's like, had I known, what would I have done? I realized now, had we worked then more together, they saw it as my book. And they always said, you know, you do what you like. There was never, there was never talk of them reading it through. But had we had that, they would probably have realized before that, we don't like the way she writes after all. And there would have been no book. So how to say, luckily, we can't live backwards. So, of course, I couldn't have done it in that way had I known that some of them didn't like it, the bookseller in particular. But it's also like the bookseller, because I write this, he's a dual character of being very pro-West on one side and living very pro-Afghan traditions on the other side. So maybe he doesn't see that duality himself, but in the book it's very apparent how he wants to please two worlds. And had he seen that, he would have, no, you can't write. It's like, it wouldn't have been any book. So, I mean, as journalists, if we have the consent to write a book, we have to do it our way. It's my book on the cover, and it's my book. And the family, I mean, nothing bad has come out of it for the family either.
You've spent most of your career as a foreign correspondent, but your most recent book One of Us is about Norway, is about your home, and it's about Anders Behring Breivik. Let's start from the beginning with that. When that attack happened in 2011, where were you at the time?
Well, exactly on the day of the attack, I was at home. It was Friday afternoon, so it was beginning of the weekend. And I was going away to an island on the shore of Norway with some friends. They were having a big party at a friend's house. So we were going with three of us, two friends and me, and I'm bringing my children, who were 1 and 3 at the time. So as we were leaving Oslo, I got a message on my phone saying, stay away from the city centre. And of course, that's kind of a signal to listen to the radio, what's going on. And then they said on the radio that the whole facade was missing from the government building where the prime minister had his office. And I was thinking right away, this was probably a terror act by Al-Qaeda. And the next moment, what happened was I got a phone call from Marie Colvin. She asked me, are you in Norway? And I said, yes, I'm in Norway. Well, yeah, can you cover the story for us? And I was like sitting there with my children on my way out of Oslo. And I couldn't just leave them and be my old self and leave them to my friends and just go back to Oslo. So I didn't, but we carried on to that island. And once we got there several hours later, people were watching the TV. And I remember the pictures of these youngsters swimming from the island, like really swimming quickly and with force. And at the time, there was just some information that there had been some shooting at this island where there was this Labour Party youth camp. So everything was very, yeah, there was not much information at that time. Only the next morning, we got the number of then, 77 people killed, and that the perpetrator was a Norwegian man, and his name and his age and where he lived. And we realized that he had lived on my street, actually. So that was the start. And then I was called up by Tina Brown in Newsweek, who asked me to get anything I could on that man, which was Breivik. So my first story was for Newsweek.
And then your reporting grew and you decided to write this book. What were the reasons behind trying to write a book about this attack?
Well, I started to write a book much later because when I'd done my big article for Newsweek, I was going back to the Middle East because I had a contract for Newsweek to cover the Arab Spring. So I just went back to Tripoli, where I had been earlier in the summer, and I covered the fall of Gaddafi and what would come after him. And I started a book, actually, in Tripoli. So I was not thinking that this was anything for me. I'd done my article. And then the next year, in April, there was going to be the trial, 9 months after the attack. And then I was again asked by Newsweek to cover the start of it. And I got my accreditation and I got a seat in the courtroom and prepared myself for it. But I wasn't really prepared. So the first day when Breivik came in and it all started, you had the parents of the bereaved there, you had some of the survivors. I was just knocked sideways by everything. And I realized that this is more than an article. And I just, after a couple of days or weeks, I realized I had to dig deeper into this and to write a book. I never expected it to be 500 pages, but I just decided this is, why do I always go on the other side of the planet to write about other people's tragedies when this has happened among us and in our country, and we don't understand why.
And that issue of not understanding why this has happened amongst us in this country, do you feel any closer to an answer on that question now?
Hardly. Of course, I shouldn't say that after having written 500 pages. Of course, there's so many factors, but there's not one dramatic reason. And there are many small explanations, and some are personal, some are psychological, some are political. And I think that on one level, he did it for himself. He's a narcissist. That's the only diagnosis he ended up with in court. Narcissistic traits in his personality, which is not a real diagnosis that will make that you won't get punished or anything. It's you're still sane, considered sane. So he did it to be seen and to be read and to be admired. And hopefully he followed. That's what was his goal. But then, of course, on the other hand, it's a very political attack. He's a political terrorist, and he did this. The ultimate goal of his was to rid Europe of Muslims.
You mentioned before you have two small children, but you've also still been doing some foreign correspondence. Do you think that you'll reach a stage where you think actually you want to stay in Norway and write more books in Norway, on Norway, on Norwegian issues, rather than travelling abroad?
I'm trying to combine, actually, because it's like, I don't think I can come up with for the rest of my life Norwegian issues. But I did continue my book. When I'm done with this book, I picked up my Libyan book again. But now, unfortunately, it's too dangerous. I'm not going there now. It's there's too much killing. ISIS is there. And for me, ISIS is so terrifying. I wouldn't go to a country where they are, because you just know what will be your end if they take you. And you can, in a country like Libya, which is a total anarchy, you can so easily be kidnapped by anyone, because it's just by any criminals. And once they get you, they can trade you further up in the system until you end up with ISIS. So I put that book on hold, unfortunately. It's a book about a neighborhood, so I would have, it's not a book where I could go in quickly and leave. I would have to stay for a longer period of time, so I would be very easy to, I would be in very easy targets. But I've started a new book now, which is where I can link Norway into what's happening in the Middle East. And that's a book about, I'm following two foreign fighters, or two foreign volunteers, you might say, because they're not really fighting. Two Somali sisters who grew up in Norway and left to join ISIS in 2013. And they're still there now in Syria, in Raqqa. And I'm trying to find out, just as I was asking in the case of Breivik, like, why did they take that choice? Why did they have to, you know, join a terror organization? Why did they have to, what was wrong in Norway? Why couldn't they live a life in Norway? So it's like the same questions, and trying to work in the same way, asking friends and family and teachers and whatever is a written material. And then, of course, trying to find their way into Syria, and how is their lives now as Raqqa housewives?
You mentioned at the start how your own parents had moved from Oslo to Lillehammer to have this more simple, freer life, no TV, less sort of connections to the outside world, no car. And now you've turned into the sort of person who goes all over the world and is travelling all over the world and is writing about things all over the world. Do you have your own views about what you expect your children, what you want your children to do, or how you want them to grow up in a world that seems quite different from the one that you grew up in?
Oh, that's interesting. I've actually never thought of it. What do I want my children to become? It's probably when you get children, you realize that they're very much their own, that they are their own 100% personalities. So I don't know, but I just want them to be happy. I don't really have any ambitions for them. I want them to be happy. And of course, to be happy, you need to fulfill something in your life, I think you also have to be a bit disciplined. So there's certain things that, yes, we can't just, you know, it's not growing up in a hedonistic family, but also teach them, like, you know, to be disciplined and hardworking and all that. But they're still young. They're 4 and 6, soon to be 5 and 7. Yeah, I just want them to fulfill their dreams.
Åsne Sarstad, thank you very much indeed. That was the journalist and writer Åsne Sarstad talking to me, Steve Bloomfield, for the big interview on Monocle 24. Next week, tune in to hear Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck meeting the designer Thomas Heatherwick. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.